I'm going to be reading from Luke chapter 6, beginning at verse 39. And the reading can be found in the Church Bibles on page 1039. Luke chapter 6, beginning at verse 39. He also told them a parable. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, "Brother, let me take out the speck that is in your eye," when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take out the speck that is in your brother's eye. For no good tree bears bad fruit, nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. The good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks.
Lucy, thank you very much for reading to us. This week we come to the fourth in a series of five sermons, looking at this great sermon that Jesus preaches in Luke chapter 6. It might be helpful to have it open in front of you if you've already closed your Bible. If you'd like to follow, then it's on page 1039 and 1040 of the Bibles on your seats. Also on the back side of your notice sheet, you'll find a roadmap through this morning's service. That might help to have that to hand. This last week, one of our congregations sent me a feature from a newspaper called "I Want to Change My Life." And it was a discussion of the high levels of personal dissatisfaction amongst young professionals. We were told that more than 80% of 30 to 35-year-old professionals claim they are unhappy at work, worn down by a combination of stress, boredom, and aspiration deficit, which means the feeling that their job isn't giving back as much as they put into it. The phenomenon has even given birth to its own acronym. You're not a proper social phenomenon until you've got your own acronym, are you? And this particular acronym is TIRED, 30-something independent radical educated dropouts. Tireds. People leave well-paid but dissatisfying jobs in favour of something less lucrative but more fulfilling. Why be a fund manager when you can run a B&B in the south of France? And in the search for change and meaning, people will often turn to lifestyle teachers, won't they? So we were introduced to Anne-Marie Woodall, the author of Secrets of a High-Heeled Healer, or the wonderfully named Poe Bronson, author of What Should I Do With My Life? The hunger of our hearts generates a desire for teachers who will help us to change. You don't have to be attired to desire change or meaning. And over the last few weeks, as we've looked at this sermon in Luke chapter 6, we've heard Jesus call for a radical change of lifestyle among his followers. He's invited anyone who would want to follow him to turn their criteria for success on their heads as they begin to image God by loving their enemies. And this week, the question he asks us is, what teacher are you going to listen to see that change happen? What kind of person must you become to be capable of loving your enemies? And it's a fantastic piece of preaching by Jesus. He throws a kaleidoscope of images at us. He mixes metaphors as he goes. We'll see trees become treasure boxes in the blink of an eye. So how do you become a person who images God by loving their enemies? First of all, you'll see it there on your sheet. Check your eyes. Check your eyes, verses 39 to 42. Jesus knows that self-righteousness is the enemy of imaging a merciful God. If you're convinced of your own goodness and blind to your own flaws, then your stance towards other people will be to instinctively judge them. And it's a form of behavior that we saw Jesus ruling out last week in verse 37. He said, "Judge not, and you will not be judged." You will never love your enemies if you stay in that frame of mind. So the parable he's about to tell us in 39 following warns anyone who would follow Jesus against following blind guides who will reinforce a self-righteous, hypocritical attitude in our lives. And Jesus has probably got the scribes and the Pharisees in his sights, the people who, verse 11 tells us, were angry at him and looking for a way to do away with him. So Jesus asks two simple rhetorical questions in verse 39. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? Self-evident, isn't it? I was changing trains on the tube the other day, and there was a blind man in my carriage. And as we pulled into the station, he made his way to the door, and waiting outside was an employee of London Underground who took his arm and helped him to change to his next train. It would have been absurd, wouldn't it, if that blind man had phoned London Underground, telling them where and when he would be arriving, and London Underground had sent a blind employee in order to help him to his next train. They would both have ended up in the track or just not being able to find where they wanted to go. That's the kind of image that Jesus is using, isn't he? Can a blind man lead a blind man? The answer is no. So verse 40, if you follow blind guides, then you'll end up like them. A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Jesus is presenting them with a choice. Will you go the way of the scribes and Pharisees, self-righteous, hard-hearted judgmentalism? Or will you go my way? Will you follow my teaching? Will you image a kind and merciful God as you love your enemies? Who are you going to be like? Now, Jesus doesn't leave it there, does he? Just so we are sure we know what this kind of blindness looks like, Jesus gives us this graphic and amusing image in verses 41 to 42. And I think we've grown so used to it, this talk of specks and logs, that we've missed its absurdity. He describes a speck spotter with a log in their eye. Can you picture it? Look at Pete Orr down here. Pete Orr's one of my colleagues by the pillar. Stand up a minute, Pete. He didn't know I was going to do this to him, so he's not blushing. For those of you listening on the tape, Pete Orr is 6'4". He's dark, handsome, and has muscles on his muscles. But imagine Pete has this in his eye. Can you see it? You probably can't, can you? It's just a speck of wood, a tiny piece of wood. It's barely there. But I'm concerned about Pete and the speck in his eye. How can he live life with that kind of splinter in his eye? Pete, you can sit down, okay? But meanwhile, as I look at Pete and his speck in his eye, I've got this in mine. And I'm so concerned about the speck in Pete's eye, that I haven't noticed it? You see, that's the absurd picture that Jesus is painting, and I'm sure his listeners would have laughed as you laugh. I've got a far bigger problem than him, but all that I can see is his problem. It's a funny image, isn't it? The speck spotter with a log in his eye. But unfortunately, according to Jesus, it is a terrible reality. Jesus punches with severe words in verse 42. Can you see them? You hypocrite, he says. If that's you, you hypocrite. You're pretending that your life is sorted out enough to give you the luxury of judging others, when in reality, you're in a far worse state. Now, maybe you've been on the receiving end of a speck spotter's campaign. It seems that every move you make is subject to their moral scrutiny and judgment. They are obsessed with fine moral distinctions and nuances, and generally a speck spotter will lack any sense of joy and fun, and they are determined that no one else will have any either. It's stifling, it's claustrophobic, it will suck the life out of you if you are somebody who is so concerned about the specks in other people's eyes that you fail to spot the log in your own. But notice what Jesus says. Jesus doesn't descend into an anything-goes mentality. That's not what he means by not judging. The speck is real, and it needs to be removed from your brother's eye at the end of verse 42. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take out the speck that is in your brother's eye. But your priority, if you were to be a follower of Jesus, needs to be dealing with the log in your own eye first. The person who is to image a merciful God needs to see their own faults before they start dealing with other people's faults. If I begin with the log in my own eye, then it gives me a humility when I start dealing with other people's specks. If I realize how much I need the mercy of God, then I'm not in a position to be harshly judgmental towards others. We'll come back to that at the end of this talk, and we will try and work it through as to what it might look like in our lives. But the next time you spot a speck in somebody else's eye, stop before you do or say anything. Examine your own life and remind yourself of the mercy of God. Don't follow blind guides, Jesus says. They will take you into a pit. Well, it's all very well to say that, but what's the key to being like that? Secondly, Jesus says, check your heart. Check your heart in verses 43 to 45. I've got all kinds of rubbish on this pulpit now from that wretched log. I should have hosed it down before I came in. So excuse me if I'm brushing bits away. Jesus says, secondly, check your hearts. And in these verses, Jesus tells us that he's not looking for superficial behavioral change. Anyone can affect that to some degree with the right therapy. If you get the right therapist, they will be able to affect some kinds of behavioral change in your life. But Jesus is looking for something far deeper and more profound in the lives of his followers. He's looking, these verses will tell us, for a change of heart. And the heart in the Bible is the control center right at the focal point of our lives. It's what drives our thoughts and our actions and our behavior. That's where the action is, according to Jesus. And he throws two images at us to tell us what he means. The first is there in verses 43 and 44. Can you see it? For no good tree bears bad fruit. Nor again does a bad tree bear good fruit. For each tree is known by its own fruit. For figs are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor are grapes picked from a bramble bush. It's a simple image, isn't it? Let me take you on a trip into my garden. Contrary to popular opinion, I haven't yet concreted it over, although my neighbour has had a good go in recent weeks. If you waded through the weeds at the back door, you would find on the right of my garden a fairly immature apple tree that was planted there by the people who lived in the house before us. It's probably only been there 7 or 8 years. But as you'd expect, in the pure East End sun and air, it's an apple tree which is thriving. The branches are strong, the leaves are green, and the roots are firm. But imagine as you make your way through my garden with me, you begin to notice that the fruit is rotten. There are maggots eating their way through it, and you can pick up the acrid stench of fermentation. And when you pick the fruit, you discover that it's not apples at all. It's poisonous berries. You see, it doesn't happen like that, does it? That's the point Jesus is making. The kind of tree that it is will produce a particular kind of fruit. As the root is, so the fruit will be. A healthy tree where the roots are right will bear healthy fruit. If the tree was sickly, then you would expect the fruit to be sickly too. So Jesus says, imagine your heart is like a tree. What kind of fruit does it grow? You can tell the state of your heart by the way you speak and live your life, particularly in private. It's very easy, isn't it, to put on a good face for an hour on a Sunday morning as we come into church. We all look respectable in our own way, and we can con people, can't we? But it's in the moments when we think nobody is looking or listening, or when we're with people close to us, that our hearts expose their tree, their fruit. Or Jesus says, look at it this way in verse 45. Imagine your heart is a treasure chest. What kind of treasure does it produce? The good person, out of the good treasure of his heart, produces good. And the evil person, out of his evil treasure, produces evil. You might have seen Pirates of the Caribbean over the summer. It's a fantastic film, well worth going to see at least 3 times. It's got every pirate cliche that you would want in a film in abundance. And there's good treasure and bad treasure at the heart of the film. And the bad treasure, they're trying to turn into good treasure against all the odds. That's the picture Jesus is using here. Is your heart full of good treasure or bad treasure? He sums up the whole point he's making at the end of verse 45. Out of the abundance of the heart, his mouth speaks. What's inside will come out one way or another. So can you see how Jesus is driving to the root of the issue? The judgmental hypocrite who is following a blind guide has a heart problem that needs radical surgery. And the temptation when we find ourselves with a log in our eye is to go for superficial cosmetic surgery. We think a moral nip and tuck will sort us out. Some spiritual Botox will do the job, and no one will ever know the state of our hearts. Last year, my father had, I think it ended up being triple heart surgery. He'd known there was a problem for some years, eventually went to the doctor, and they did all the various tests that they do on you to discover what the problem is. And can you imagine, as he walked into the cardiac consultant's room, the cardiac consultant told him the problem, that he had severe arterial blockages, encroaching heart disease, and then he said to him, Mr. Jones, we think we'll do a facelift. But somehow, sometimes, that's how we live, isn't it? Sometimes that's how we live. The problem is the heart. It needs radical surgery, and yet we go for the facelift. And maybe that's what's happening amongst the tireds. There is dissatisfaction in high-pressured, lucrative jobs. There is a hunger in the heart for something more. And we go for the facelift of running a B&B in the south of France. And maybe that's you, maybe it's me. We need something deeper. You see, the Christian version of the facelift is moral exhortation. The preacher or some other Christian will tell you that you really ought to do better. And they'll work hard at telling you just how big the log is in your eye. They'll tell you what a terrible effect it will have on your life, how much God hates it, and then they'll tell you how to work hard to take it out. So you try desperately for a few days or even weeks, and then before you even realize it, you're blindly speck-spotting again. You've heard lots of moral exhortation, you've even put in lots of moral effort, but your heart has remained unchanged. You're looking to change through fear of the consequences if you don't change. You're looking to change maybe for reasons of personal satisfaction, but somehow your heart doesn't change. Well, what is it that changes the heart? What creates good trees and good treasure chests? Well, I think Jesus gives us more to think about in verses 46 to 49, so do come back next week in two weeks, as we wrap this series up. But a simple answer in Luke 6, I think, is that it is God who changes the heart. It's God who changes the heart. How is my heart changed to produce good fruit and treasure? It's changed as I prayerfully ask God to give me a bigger grasp of his mercy and kindness. That's at the heart of Luke 6, isn't it? Verse 35. Love your enemies, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Verse 36. Be merciful. Why? Even as your Father is merciful. My heart is changed as I prayerfully ask God to give me a bigger grasp of his mercy and kindness. Let me show you how that might work this week. Imagine that I am concerned about my Christian friend who I think has got a tendency to gossip. To talk to other people about other people when the person they're talking to is neither part of the problem nor the solution to the problem. They seem to do it easily and naturally. You can't tell him anything without the rest of London finding out about it in a highly embellished form. And I need to talk to him. His behavior is damaging relationships, and it's making me mad. Now, I could phone him up, rip into him, and tell him to stop it. I've been on the receiving end of phone calls like that. Probably I needed to be on the end of receiving phone calls like that. You probably have been on the end of receiving phone calls like that. And in some ways, it's the right thing to do. He does need to stop it. There is a speck. But as I do that, my heart could be hard and full of judgment. Even as I am dialing him, I could be thinking, I'm glad I never gossip like him. He should be grateful that he's got a friend like me who's upstanding enough to confront him. Then, if he does express any remorse and say, yeah, I'm aware that I've been gossiping and I need to cut it out, I could end up feeling self-satisfied at a job well done. We've all been there in one shape or another, I'm sure, whether we're a Christian or not. When we've confronted somebody with a problem and then they express remorse, there is a certain sense of inbuilt self-satisfaction, isn't there? That's one way of dealing it. The self-righteous, harsh phone call. Or here's another way to deal with it. I think the Luke 6 way to deal with it. Before I pick up the phone, I spend time praying. Before I pray for my friend, I ask God to open my eyes to my own life. Where have I gossiped? Where have I passed on negative information about another person in order to look better myself? Where has my heart chased after another person's approval as I tell them a half-truth more than it has chased after God himself? And as I begin to prayerfully see those things, the state of my own heart, I ask God to help me to turn from them. I ask him to show me more and more how kind and merciful he is. I don't need to be in the business of assassinating people through gossip, because God is not in the business of assassinating people through gossip. God is so not into the business of assassinating people that Jesus has died for them. He is kind and merciful to the ungrateful. So when I reach a point, prayerfully speaking to God, when I reach a point where my heart is rejoicing in God's mercy to me as a gossip, then I am in position to pick up the phone and arrange to speak to my friend face to face. Because my heart has been changed. My heart has been changed through mercy and grace. I've seen God for who he is. I've seen myself for who I am, with a log in my eye. And I am then enabled to deal with the speck in my brother's eye. Can you see how it works? The kindness and mercy of God towards people with logs and specks in their eye. So this week, which way are we going to go? Are we going to follow the Pharisees and the scribes and be speck spotters with logs in our eye and bad hearts? Or through the kindness and mercy of God, are we going to follow Jesus as clear-eyed, good-hearted disciples, living our lives deliriously in the face of his kindness and mercy? Let's pray.